Your trusted source for news and analysis about Chicago White Sox prospects and player development, covering the Major League Baseball draft and international market, plus the action in Kannapolis, Winston-Salem, Birmingham, and Charlotte. This is the Future Sox Podcast with your hosts, Mike Rankin and James Fox.
Welcome to another episode of the Future Sox Podcast. My name is Mike Rankin. I'll be your host. James Fox, senior writer at Future Sox, is joining me. Now, I'm going to depart in the middle of this episode, so you'll notice that you'll be hearing a lot of James Fox, which is totally fine because there's a lot of information coming your way on this episode, as Brian Sikowski of Perfect Game will be joining us to break down the Chicago White Sox draft class, give us a little perspective on what they were able to do across the 20-round draft in which they signed everyone plus an extra 10 undrafted free agents. So that's something that you can look forward to in this episode. But James, first, let's kick it off with a recap of the trade deadline, or the lack thereof, because the Chicago White Sox, to many fans' dismay, stood pat essentially outside of Jake Diekman, and they didn't move anybody from within the system. They traded Zach Collins for Reese McGuire at the beginning of the season, and Reese McGuire was traded for Jake Diekman, left-handed relief pitcher who's already made a few outings already with the White Sox and has looked good. But that's it. A left-handed bullpen arm to conclude the midseason for the Chicago White Sox. How are you feeling about this overall? A lot of fans, like I said, were pretty upset that Rick Hahn wasn't able to land a big fish or even a bat, like a secondary, a complimentary piece, not any additions to the starting rotation. Are you frustrated with the way things turned out, or can you understand why Rick Hahn failed at acquiring more talent?
So I think it's super complex. I think for days I was they have to add because they're in a contention window, all the stuff that we've talked about, right? And I mentioned Jose Quintana and Tyler Naquin and David Peralta. And as those guys started moving off the board, I was kind of they have to have another target here somewhere. So, talking to people, I was under the impression that the White Sox obviously would have trouble getting anything with a lot of control. I know they've liked Tyler Malley in the past, and the Twins got him, obviously. And that's a trade that's tough to make for the White Sox because you're dumping out guys that we talk about all the time, and they probably didn't want to give up their top prospects in a deal. So, but I had also heard that if they were in the rental market, they should be able to do that. You see these deals and it's the White Sox should have been able to make a deal like that. So I don't really know what happened. I do know that they set a target list, which seems like an issue, right? If you know that you need an upgrade, you shouldn't be targeting one or two guys. You should be more open-minded to getting something done. Obviously, guys like Tyler Naquin and David Peralta moved days before the deadline. So maybe that, I guess to me, I just assumed Jock Peterson was finally coming and San Francisco would sell and they didn't. So yeah, it was very strange. I said ahead of time that they needed to buy because I think standing pat doesn't really make any sense. But then once they stood pat, I kind of shrugged my shoulders and was okay. I just didn't really care that much. And, part of that is I think it makes our jobs a little bit easier that no prospects were traded. But I don't know. I don't even know. What's the deal that you really wanted them to make? I think I would have been happy with Quintana. That would have been cool, depending on what they gave up. And a Jock Peterson, I thought, would have fit to have a left-handed bat that, you could replace Sheets with or something. But I mean, other than that, I don't know. I kind of thought it would be a reliever and maybe a left-handed bat of some sort, but they only did the Jake Diekman move.
Well, I can understand that perspective and how you feel that way, because it's frustrating to look at this White Sox team from a fan's perspective, but imagine looking at it through Rick Hahn's eyes, where the roster isn't managed to its potential. And even if you do feel like you can add, is it enough or is it even worth it? Are you compromising what you're working toward, which is developing a farm system that was from first to last over the last couple of seasons? Now they've been sitting at the bottom. They've been taking multiple seasons to get to a point where they're starting to see some of the fruits of their labor in these prospects. And not saying that we should be valuing these prospects higher or anything else in that regard, considering where the White Sox stand in their competitive window, because look, this is the time of year when good teams buy. But to be fair, this was a seller's market. I mean, the sellers did have the leverage, which was maybe to Rick Hahn's detriment. Maybe the offseason was a little bit more significant than we thought in terms of the struggles and trying to acquire what you need because of the lockout pre and post, how the market changed so quickly. I can only speculate in that regard. But when it comes to the trade deadline and the decision to stand pat, not that they didn't try, because I know the White Sox were trying, and I know White Sox fans out there are scoffing at that phrase because often they're trying to acquire, but you want them to be in on guys and also understand that there are also multiple teams in on that same player, and they can just simply out-leverage the White Sox right now. Because when teams hear that, say, like the Cardinals are giving up whatever they're giving up for Jose Quintana or any hypothetical situation, the team is going to go to the White Sox and say, okay, here's what they offered. Give me Andrew Vaughn, or give me a headliner that is the equivalent of a close to ready major league starter. And it's hard to find that. So the next result is, are you going to trade away some of these young prospects like Colson Montgomery, Brian Ramos, Lenin Sosa, the young players that are on the brink of debuting, not so much Colson Montgomery and Ramos, but Lenin Sosa, and even Romy Gonzalez is in this conversation as well, not seriously, but those are the types of ready now players that the White Sox have at their disposal, while the highest value in their system remains their young prospects. So it's a very fine line for Rick Hahn to balance on this beam, trying to maintain some sort of congruity in terms of the major league window being competitive enough to try to challenge for a World Series, while also understanding that if you compromise the farm system for this team, you might be setting yourself back multiple years. So as I'm thinking this through, I'm trying to see it through Rick Hahn's eyes, and that's what I came up with, James. How do you feel about that assessment?
Yeah, I think it's fair. I mean, a couple things for me, something that was very frustrating, but also where I think you're right. Like, something we've said, like, I don't think they were trading Colson Montgomery, and I don't think they were trading Oscar Colas. So, like, at that point, like, anybody in your system that, like, we would have been, like, willing to deal, right? Like, not to speculate, like, completely on, like, trade packages, but I mean, like, look, like, in that next mix of guys, you have Jose Rodriguez and Ramos and guys like that and the pitchers, right? I think those guys, like, aren't good enough yet to headline a package for a controllable piece, and I think they're too good to trade for a rental, like 8 Jose Quintana starts, or Tyler Naquin to be the, you know, the strong side of an outfield platoon. So I think, like, that's where they run into problems. Like, you see the Jose Quintana deal, you know, the third baseman, I think, like Malcolm Nunez, that went from the Cardinals to the Pirates. I mean, you read the scouting report, the guy sounds an awful lot like Brian Ramos. Like, if the White Sox make that trade, people are freaking out right now, I feel like. So, and this isn't to excuse them, because the thing that's super annoying is, like, they completely botched the offseason. And whether it's, yes, and whether it's Rick Hahn or the entire front office, like, I push back when it's like, fire Rick Hahn, because, I mean, it's like, not just him. Like, if you want to clear out the whole front office, like, okay, fine. But I mean, like, The front office and ownership as a collective messed up this offseason badly. And then they said, like, oh, we'll have money to spend at the deadline. Like, we'll just fix it at the deadline. But then a deadline comes and they don't do anything, which is super. So, like, that's the part where, like, they should be held accountable, in my opinion. Like, look, sometimes, like, you can't make trades at the deadline. Like, I don't want them making stupid trades either. Like, I don't. It doesn't make any sense. And it's easy for us to say, like, oh, Rick, like, what do you mean you're upset? Like, it's your fault. You could have traded whoever you want. But, like, that's not really true. Like, that doesn't mean that, you know, that they should have made a trade. Then don't tell me in the offseason that, like, you're saving moves for the deadline, right? Because then it's like, oh, yeah, now it's like, oh, yeah, we'll get better in the winter. And then you don't spend any money in the winter. It's just, like, this endless cycle of nonsense. That's the problem that I have with, like, the whole situation.
Right. And James, you're so right, because it begins in the offseason. It's the same process, and it's been very similar over the last three competitive seasons. When they set themselves up, the White Sox do, for financial flexibility, it's time to spend. And yet they take that flexibility into the season because it allows them to survey the market and figure out their needs and then attack at the deadline. Well, that's happened in three consecutive seasons now. They went hard last year and acquired a couple of strong trade pieces that ultimately cost you some, you know, valuable products, but I mean, at the end of the day, I think you just bite the bullet on a couple of returns there. It's just you made the moves to try to win. But at the same time, when you have an opportunity to upgrade at positions in the offseason where your payroll is at its highest, we're on $196 million, if I'm not mistaken, that's still, I think, top 10 in Major League Baseball, yet the threshold, the tax, luxury tax is $230 million. And the White Sox have all the resources in the world to be able to handle whatever that they take on in terms of contract length. But we know that the owner doesn't want to do that. And the White Sox are typically not ones to invest multiple years of control into free agency into a starting pitcher. And they definitely, definitely don't want to invest a multi-year contract into a bat that'll tie them to that one player for more than 4 to 5 years, more than 5 years outside of the outliers in Luis Robert and the young players in Moncada and Aloy and Anderson, so on. So it's like when they're fishing in free agency, we've seen the same outcome. It's we're going to try to budget our financial flexibility across 4 to 5 players. We'll take the $15 million that we could have gave to Carlos Rodon on the qualifying offer, $18 million that we could have gave to Carlos Rodon, and spread it out to 5 to 6 players. When these 5 to 6 players aren't getting the job done, when you could have invested that same sum into a player who fits a position where you're seeing negative WAR in the outfield defensively from a guy who plays first base. You know, there are things like that that drive me crazy about the way the White Sox front office is going about organizing this roster. Because when it comes to, and James, I'll let you finish up. I'm sorry to get on this tangent, but it just, you unlock something in my head. When it comes to dedicating their capital draft selections to a specific philosophy, what are they looking for in the draft? And this is prior to Mike Shirley. They're looking for the best value they can find at their position in the draft, wherever that lands, right? Of course. But the White Sox took Zach Collins. The White Sox took Gavin Sheets in the second round. They took Jake Berger in the first round. They took Andrew Vaughn in the first round. They took Madrigal because of his profile. But outside of Nick Madrigal, the consistency over the last 4 to 5 seasons have been bat first. And when you have bat first, that's fine when you're organizing a big league roster to accommodate to those players. But when you're asking those players to play important positions every day, you are going to see what we're seeing this year in the White Sox. Inconsistency in the little things. Poorly developed mechanically. Guys out of position that are ultimately getting you in trouble. So that's where my frustrations lie, James. It's the fact that you do so well to prepare for financial flexibility at a time when you can spend, and yet they decide to remain conservative.
Well, yeah, and like you look at certain spots where like I think they've done okay, but they still like you spend all this money on the bullpen, right? And like I don't even really care about that. Like Kendall Graveman and Joe Kelly and whoever, like spend whatever you want. I feel like it can't stop you from making other moves, and it like clearly does, right? You bring back Leury Garcia, you sign Josh Harrison, and Josh Harrison's been okay, I think. But and Romy Gonzalez has been hurt. So, like, my argument probably doesn't hold water here, but it's like, you know, you saw what Mendick was capable of. You have Romy Gonzalez, you know, you have Yolbert Sanchez, who's struggled lately, who could fill in, but then you have Lenin Sosa, and you have, like, Jose Rodriguez coming. It's just like, it seems like there are spots where you could just promote guys internally. Like, look at what Jimmy Lambert's turned into, and they've kind of fixed Ronaldo Lopez. Like, you have some homegrown bullpen guys and some homegrown guys that could play the middle infield better than Leury Garcia has. So just take that money and get something useful instead. It's why the, you know, people are sick and tired of hearing about Carlos Rodon, but it's why that decision was so bad. Like, the process behind it was just awful. And then the Craig Kimbrel decision, like, I think that was a good trade. Like, I agree with you. Like, the process at last year's deadline to go out and get the best closer, like, on the market was fine, and it didn't work. But for whatever reason, they didn't accept, like, the sunk cost fallacy, and they had to get something for him, and it hurt you. And it's just, like, the offseason was terrible. And it led into this deadline where I actually thought they might go out and try to like salvage it a little bit with some pieces. And maybe they tried, but it didn't work. So, I mean, I do like the Jake Diekman addition. I think that's a guy who I've always kind of liked, who walks too many guys, but like, I trust Ethan Katz with him. Like that move's fine. They just, you know, they can't hit. So they, you know, if Jake Diekman could hit, like maybe the deal would be better. But he, you know, that's not his job.
Yeah, and well, when you're evaluating this White Sox team, you ask yourself, what's missing? And first and foremost, I think the manager has to get out of the dugout, okay? First, like, literally leave. Go away. I don't want him a part of this team. I'm sorry if, like, people are sick of hearing about that too, but I just feel like this organization will take a step in the right direction, whatever that step may be, if it's large, if it's small, I don't care. But you're going forward if La Russa's out as the manager of the White Sox. So that's number one. Number two, James, you mentioned the fact that the White Sox can be willing to promote from within. That is a phenomenal point because the White Sox, I think, the belief that they have within their farm system has held them back from attacking other positions in free agency. And I'll leave you with that question, James, or that comment, and then we'll preview Brian Sikowski. But that's just me. I feel like the White Sox have a lot of confidence in cost-controlled young players that they're developing, that they are familiar with within their own system, above spending for a free agent.
See, I not enough, though, right? Because you don't have guys that I think their second baseman next year is in their system right now. I don't know who the guy is, you know, but I think, like, that's fine. But, I mean, they just have all these square pegs that they're sticking in round holes. Like, we've talked about this. We've talked about how good Andrew Vaughn is. I don't ever want to see him in the outfield ever again. It's so bad. And, like, if you look on, like, his Fangraphs page or whatever, like, his offensively, he's been, I think, pretty much what we thought. Like, maybe we thought more power. I think more power will come, right? But, like, the playing in the outfield is completely cratering his value. And it gets into a larger discussion that's maybe more appropriate for Sox Machine than here about, you know, Jose Abreu and just like some of the other parts on the roster that they're just going to have to answer at some point. But it's like they've just not cared about defense for so long that it's like, oh, we have all these guys that we're committed to, like turn them into outfielders. And it hasn't worked. So, you know, yeah, I mean, they've had some faith in their, but they just spend in weird spots. And like it doesn't really make any sense. So I don't know. It's just and we have a lot of games left still, and they have a shot, obviously, but it's just, this is like not fun at all. I heard on your show the other day, I heard Dan Bernstein say that, how it's like, man, I had a great day, and you know, whatever, like you find fun and you know, you go out and do it, and then you turn on the White Sox game and it's just like, ugh. And I agree. Like it's just, when they win, I feel like you're not even happy. You're just like relieved that they didn't lose again. And that's like not what we anticipated when they did all this. And we talked about all these guys when they were actual prospects, right? It's just this was like not supposed to be this way.
They can't play. They're not good. They can't beat good teams either.
Well, so what you brought up though earlier too with the Han thing, like he's totally right about like the home runs. But like, you know, at some point, it's on the organization. These guys all didn't decide to just like stop hitting homers. Like something happened, and I'm not a fire the hitting coach guy, right? But stuff like that like has never been more obvious with the hitting coach and Tony. And like even if it's not a fix all, it's something, and you can't fire the players. And I'm just like stunned that we're at this point, and like nothing has happened really all year, other than like them just expecting like this team to snap out of it.
I just want Tony La Russa out of the dugout, man. It's driving me crazy. And the whole hitting coach philosophy thing, like players are going to buy into the major league approach. And it's not been good, right? We're seeing some poor numbers. But also it's up to the players. You know, it's on the players to make adjustments and to understand how pitchers are attacking them. And, you know, sometimes the players have deficiencies in their game where it can be exposed and they just can't fix it. Like Yoan Moncada struggles with fastballs. Stuff like that. It happens. And we brought up, and we're going to wrap this up as we introduce Brian Sikowski at Perfect Game. You brought up Jose Abreu. I mean, that is a confounding tale of what the hell are the White Sox going to do? Because he seems to be a White Sox for life. However, we all know the significance of the position that he plays and the roster spot that he takes up and what it means for everybody else around him if he's in the lineup every day. You want that production in the lineup, especially if it continues to his career average. But all in all, you're thinking about, what the hell am I going to do with Andrew Vaughn? And how am I going to play all these DH types when Jose Abreu is aging and probably still on this team? So like you said, that is something for Sox Machine to discuss. We're going to talk to Brian Sikowski, not we, more like James. James interviewed Brian Sikowski of Perfect Game Baseball. You can follow Brian at @B_Sikowski_PG. Sikowski is Sakowski. So give Brian a follow on Twitter. And as we introduce this interview, stay tuned to the end because James Fox and I will have a conversation regarding Colson Montgomery, as well as an update on the Chicago White Sox top 30 rankings, according to ESPN. So we'll get to that. But first, Brian Sikowski next. This is the Future Sox podcast. Don't go anywhere.
We're lucky today to have Brian Sikowski, national cross checker for Perfect Game. Brian, thanks for joining us today.
Absolutely, man. Thank you for having me.
It doesn't really seem like anybody enjoys this late draft in July. And obviously, like, it was a little bit later this year just because of like the lockout and when the All-Star game happened to be. But, you know, it also doesn't seem like it's moving again anytime soon. Even like scouts and stuff that I know, obviously, like I've heard the same as you. It seems like everybody hates it. But like, if, you know, if you were tasked with making this decision, when would you have the MLB draft?
I think that the concept of having it during the College World Series is probably the best one. I know that that's negatively impactful on what ends up being a very small percentage of players, like the guys who are mid-game when they get drafted or whatever. Like, towards the end of the College World Series, I think that's when you have it. We're not. I would love for it to go back to early June, but I understand the need to make it more of a premier thing and promote the game. And I think you can. You could do a whole week of the, you know, the final week of the College World Series, and then there's the draft, and or maybe you do it at the end of conference tournaments, and you have the draft on the weekend, and then Monday is Selection Monday, and that seeds the tournament. I think Teddy Cahill from Baseball America had that idea, but something like that, to where it's, you can't do late July, like we can't have this annual cycle where each draft cycle is 14 months, kinda in some way. It's just, it doesn't work from a feasibility standpoint, not to mention stuff that I don't have to deal with. I'm not a general manager of a big league team trying to manage the trade deadline simultaneously. I don't know. I think like mid-late June would be like a fair compromise, something involving the College World Series, something involving Selection Monday, somewhere in there.
Yeah, I agree. I think June makes sense. I think that I don't think it's going to happen, obviously. And we're probably going to have you on every year and we'll talk about the same stuff and how hard it is for everybody. But, you know, so before I get into this year's class for the White Sox and just some draft stuff in general, I want to take you back to 2021. You know, the White Sox shifted their strategy a little bit, taking Colson Montgomery in round one last year, you know, a prep out of Indiana who was a multi-sport guy. And, you know, it kind of seemed like, you know, came on a little bit late and Mike Shirley loved him because he's from Indiana. Well, you know, Colson Montgomery's had a big year. He's kind of turned himself into a top 50 prospect at some publications. Are you surprised by his season after, I guess, focusing on baseball for the first time in his life?
I guess I'm not surprised that he's had a lot of success. I don't know if I expected him to do so quickly and like at an advanced level at the same time. I wouldn't have been surprised if we were having this conversation a year from now. You know, like he's tearing up A ball and he's tearing up high A. That would have made sense to me 1 year from now, looking back a year ago.
What do you think about, like, Jim Callis brought up the fact that, you know, I think a lot of people projected maybe above average to plus power for him. And he's got 8 homers, which is good. But I guess I didn't really expect him to be putting up huge on base percentage numbers, and he is, you know, he's been like a 400 OBP guy at certain spots. So was that expected at all?
It's harder to project on base numbers than it is to project power, in my opinion. So I think that he always was a guy with an approach at the amateur level. It was just, you didn't really get to see it consistently because there was so much focus on other things. Like, this guy was an incredible basketball player. Like, everyone knows that. Again, I don't want to say I'm surprised because I thought this dude was good, but I don't know if I expected a 900 OPS across two levels with power, with huge on base right away in his first full season.
So then that brings us to this year where they took another prep player in the first round, but it was interesting because, you know, the White Sox haven't taken a prep pitcher in the first round since Chris Honnell all the way back in 2001. You know, I think they surprised a lot of people by taking, you know, local kid here as we go east, Noah Schultz. What did you think about Noah Schultz, like, when you saw him, I guess, the times that you've seen him? And then, you know, what are your thoughts overall on the White Sox making that pick at number 26 in the first round?
it's all about the upside here. This dude's got probably the best upside of any prep pitcher in the class. His upside is like Randy Johnson. That's the peak here. That's the high end. A lot of ways to go to that, but you know, those types of unicorns don't come around very often just in terms of what they could be. So I thought it was, they did a great job, and they did a great job to get him for slot. Like, that's a undersold, unbelievable part of this whole thing too, is you get that kid, one of the guys with, one of the few guys with true ace upside, and you get him for slot in the late first with a small bonus pool. I thought that was a hell of a job.
Yeah, and that's one of the things. I mean, we hosted a draft show that night, and I was a little, I guess I was a little surprised. Like, I had heard that the White Sox really liked him, but you also hear the stuff about Boris and Vanderbilt. But what did you think that day? What were you hearing, or what were your expectations for Noah Schultz? Just because, you know, there were all those rumors that it was such a high number, but he was pitching summer ball here in the Chicagoland area. So it's like, you know, guys that do that aren't typically ticketed for college. So do you remember, like, just kind of, you know, what you thought that day, like signable, unsignable, like what were you thinking, like, in regards to Noah Schultz?
Yeah, I thought he was signable just because of what you said, like guys who just are going to go to school, do what Andrew Dukanich did, you know, another Midwestern guy. But, hey, appreciate everybody. I'm going to Vanderbilt. Like, thanks, but no thanks. And Schultz, rather than do that, pitched in the prospect league in the summer, multiple outings. So that to me said he was signable. I figured it wouldn't be cheap, but I thought there was a chance that AJ Preller was going to do something weird and take him at 15. And beyond that, I was just, whoever saves money early, someone's going to pop him in the comp round. That was my thoughts on that guy. I did not have any inkling of the White Sox being in there seriously. I'd heard in the weeks preceding the draft, like, hey, man, White Sox are in heavy at every one of Schultz's starts. But some of that was written off by the fact that he's a local guy. You know, the White Sox front office is not far away from where he was pitching. So there was a convenience factor there. So I had the White Sox kind of in the back of my head. I did have him assignable. I just didn't think it was going to be Chicago.
Yeah, same thing here. And like, once they make that pick, it's like, you know, I think, like, I didn't really think they'd go over slot, but you didn't know how much it was going to cost. Then you kind of knew it wasn't going to be over slot when they made their next two picks. So they were very pitching focused. But I mean, you know, you get Peyton Paulette in the second round for 1.5, and then they go over with Jonathan Cannon at 925,000, I believe, to push him down to 101. What do you think about, like, that strategy? And then I guess, like, that haul of three pitchers with your first three picks, like, with a pretty small bonus pool?
Yeah, I think they did a fair job of what you want to do. You want to balance risk and safety, right? And John Cannon, probably one of the safer guys in the draft. I don't think he's going to be anything beyond a number three or number four starter, probably closer to number four, number five, but he's probably going to move quick. He throws a lot of strikes. He was a fourth-year guy or whatever the weird deal with COVID was, but an older guy relative to the class. So you had some financial wiggle room there with that. But and Paulette's more the unknown for me than Schultz. We don't know anything about Paulette. Like, he pitched kinda as a freshman, like kinda okay. And then he had Tommy John, and there was really no high school track record on him either. So that's the wild card for me more than Schultz. We know about Schultz. That dude's either going to be really, really good, or maybe, you know what I mean? The upside is there. With Paulette, we don't even know what the upside is. People comp him to Walker Buehler, just in terms of body type and arm speed and et cetera, what they look like at the same age. But that one for me is that's the big swing, more so than Schultz. I think if you have Schultz graded as the guy with the best upside on your board, you should take him. That's not like the gut feel thing or anything like that. I think Paulette's that one.
So we'll talk about some of the other pitchers the White Sox took, but in the fourth round, you know, they finally went to the position side with Jordan Sprinkle out of UC Santa Barbara. What do you think happened to that guy this year? Because I remember, like, early in the year seeing him as maybe like a comp round guy, and Mike Shirley, you know, said in a press conference that he thought somebody got in that kid's ear and told him he needed to hit for more power, and that's kind of what happened. But do you have any thoughts on that? And just kind of, you know, he falls to the fourth round. I think it's pretty decent value still there, even, you know, even though he didn't really hit this year.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what happened, what Mr. Shirley said. Like, I think he was, you can kind of see it, the differences in the swing from when he was outstanding all summer to last spring and into this year. Like, there's a little bit more noticeable trying to get the ball in the air, and I'm a proponent of trying to get the ball in the air more, but not everybody's ideal launch angle is 30, you know, so I think there was just a, he tried to do a little bit more than who he is and got away from some of the things that made him as good as he was as far as a hitter. But that's a dude who can really pick it. Like, he can really, really play defense. He's going to play shortstop. So if you bring any of that bat back, that's a steal. And even if you don't, even if he's like a well below average hitter, he'll probably get some value out of him just as a defender. So I thought that was like a good buy low type of pick there with pretty good upside if you can get him back to what he was.
So the White Sox under Mike Shirley had been a team recently where, you know, they'd put a lot of their bonus pool like into their top couple picks, and then they're taking a lot of seniors. This year, they didn't really do that. They kind of added talent throughout all the way through round seven, essentially. Ball State lefty Tyler Schweitzer, Eric Adler of Wake Forest. I think, you know, we kind of talked about, you know, some of the good K performance and the good stuff, but he was pretty bad this year. And then Mark McLaughlin. Any thoughts on just those three guys in general?
Saw Schweitzer. I like it there. The upside's not overwhelming, but he's probably a guy that's like going to be in Double A next year and you know, some kind of swingman, fifth starter type of guy. Adler, who knows? Who knows? You might never see that guy, but he might be in the eighth inning in the big leagues. In a couple, you know, it's kind of a, I think there's more than just, you know, struggles to throw strikes going on there. Just some things they got to get right. We saw the stuff on the Cape last year. He has huge stuff. So we'll see. And McLaughlin is just he's a guy who performed really well this year at Tennessee, like had a role. Nothing overwhelming, but like that's a guy you obviously are able to sign for a little bit of a deal anyway, save some money. He's a fine middle relief.
So do you have any, like the White Sox took Ian Hamilton in round 11 some years back out of Washington State, and then they, you know, they kind of turned Cody Hoyer into like a bullpen weapon too. Is Adler similar to either of those guys?
Yeah, it's so much changeup dominant with Adler. That kind of it differentiates him a little bit from some guys in terms of, oh, you know, like the big stuff college reliever who can't throw any strikes. Like it's usually a breaking ball that the hammer is. And you're identifying breaking ball traits. And if you can hone them in enough, then like Tampa Bay does all the time. But with him, it's so changeup dominant, and it's the stuff is there. Like we know that. It's just it's kind of unplayable strikes right now. So it's not even like a, man, he's walking a guy an inning. Man, he walked two last night. Like it's pretty unplayable. So there's some stuff they got to do there, but that's the risk you take, and that's the upside of it is like, you know, if you can figure it out, the guy has the stuff to potentially close down games at the big league level. But if you can't, you know, like I said earlier, we're never gonna hear from that guy again, maybe.
So, you know, I often talk to people about the baseball draft and how it's different than other drafts. And, you know, I really need like all 20 picks, you know, before I can decide how to rank the players essentially. And the White Sox drafted seniors at 8, 9, and 10. But then on day three, something a little bit, you know, puzzling to me, and we talked a little bit pre-show, obviously, but Jacob Burke out of Miami was a transfer outfielder. He hit 13 homers. You know, he had a 2-1 strikeout to walk rate, guys. Like the White Sox haven't taken many guys like that. They gave him $225K in round 11. Mike Shirley said, you know, he's going to stay in center field and he loves the makeup and he's got power. And then in round 12, it was Brooks Baldwin, who I noticed like had lots of fans, just your typical plays all over. He won that conference's player of the year. So, you know, just anything on either of those two guys leading off day three.
Yeah, I think there's kind of a, there's a difference there. Like, all right, Baldwin's kind of the safer guy who was the player of the year and has done nothing but perform and blah, blah, blah. Everybody loves him. And you won't find any scouts who probably didn't like that guy at least a little bit. And Burke is the polarizing upside guy. He swings, misses too much. It's big and athletic and powerful and physical and, you know, has the athleticism to play center field. There's your upside. And Baldwin's kind of your matching safety to go along with that. So like we talked about what they did with pitchers early on, they kind of did that right there in 11 and 12 too.
You know, whether it's the seniors, Elko and those guys in 8, 9, and 10, or anybody else on day three, anybody else that you thought like, oh, that's kind of an interesting pick for them, like where, you know, where they took a guy?
Yeah, the 16th rounder, Stevers from Texas State, unbelievable numbers, threw a lot as a reliever for them. I think he kind of did some swingman stuff, but like a lot of usage, a lot of innings, a lot of strikeouts, minimal walks. He's old. You know, I think he's 24, 25 already. It's just like I think that he's going to be kind of one of those quick mover, under the radar, all of a sudden that dude's in AAA and he's a usable up and down type of guy. Like, you know, not nothing overwhelming or sexy there, but that's a guy who you may get the first value out of at the big league level. You know, not necessarily projecting that, but again, I don't think the upside's overwhelming, but this dude who all of a sudden this White Sox 16th rounder has 70 big league innings in 6 years or so. Like, I wouldn't be surprised by that.
Yeah, I think there's a few of these guys who, like, next year, all of a sudden, like, they're in the bullpen, like, in double A already. Like, it just kind of seems like, and you know, if, like, a couple of tweaks, like, all of a sudden, a guy's in the big leagues, and it's like, oh, where did this come from? The White Sox have actually done an okay job of doing that with guys. So, you know, we kind of talked about how these classes are colliding a little bit. You know, I just want you to touch on just next year's class. Like, it seems like more premium prep hitters. Like, it seems like every year these guys are more advanced than ever, and it's kind of what you do. So I think you're the perfect guy to talk about. I mean, obviously Indiana's got another one, and then there's a few more. So what do you it's a while from now, but what do you like about next year's class early on?
Yeah, it's, I don't know if the high school class has the same level of high end as this one. And obviously you're talking about Max Clark. That's a guy that the college bats at the high end are better next year. You know, Dylan Cruz is right there. Jacob Gonzalez is right there. We talk about Max Clark, Wyatt Langford from Florida. Like, those are what looks to be the top of the class. Like, Enrique Bradfield is in that mix. But I don't know if, like, there's four or five guys who people might have sevens on, like there were in this class. Talking about, you know, Elijah Green and Drew Jones and Tamar Johnson, like that group, Cam Collier, et cetera.
Yeah, so in regards to that, like, next year's class, though, like, is it a little bit different? Like, how interested are you, like, in the draft lottery? And do you think it's really changed anything? I mean, you know, paying attention to some of these big league clubs at the bottom, or teams going to try to jockey into those first three spots to have, like, the high? I'm very curious to see how this goes with, like, this draft lottery for the first time.
Yeah, I mean, tanking still exists in sports that have lotteries already, so I don't think that that's necessarily going to curtail it, you know, like a less of an odds of you getting the first overall pick now doesn't really move the needle for an owner to necessarily add $40 million in salary or something to try and compete. So I'm cynical, but I don't know if it's really going to do anything.
Yeah. I feel like, I mean, I'm the same. I just kind of think, you know, like, if you're the Nationals or the Reds or whatever, now, like, you really want, like, there's no incentive for you to not have a bottom three record. Like, you have to get in and look, and maybe the ping pong balls or whatever don't bounce your way. But I mean, there's really no reason to not get that, like, 16.5% chance or whatever it is.
Right. Yeah. There's nothing that's really going to curtail the upside of tanking, or, like, the perceived upside of tanking. So, like, I'm with you. I think we're in lockstep on it.
Yeah. So before I get to my last thing here, the White Sox came into this draft, I think they spent close to their, you know, their 5% overage, like $6.5 million, something in that range. Bottom three spending capabilities in the class. How do you think they did overall? I mean, obviously, like, look, you know, the players could be whatever, just, like, strategically, did what they do make sense with, like, the bonus pool that they had?
Yeah, and I thought they were going to have to get more creative than they did, especially, like we talked about earlier, especially when 26 was Schultz, or, you know, it was like, okay, well, now they're going to have to cut it too, probably, and what are they going to be able to do, and do they even have enough money to move around and play in three and four, whatever. Like, so when you're able to get Schultz for slot there, then all of a sudden it frees up your board. And okay, now we can go get a Peyton Paulette. They did it so well that they didn't have to be creative, I guess is the way I'm saying it. Like, when you get your guy, your pick for that slot, you don't, that's gotta be a win. That's not, you know, like, oh man, I wish we would have been able to cut and get a bunch more guys later. Like, no, you got your guy. And you paid him what the slot is. So I think that the lack of creativity is more complimentary because of how good they did at 26.
You know, we keep talking about the late draft, obviously. Like, how about what the late draft did for a guy like Cade Horton? You see him pitch in the College World Series and whatnot. And, I mean, that guy, like, if the draft is in early June, like, Cade Horton's probably back at Oklahoma next year, right?
Yeah. He probably is. Or his number drops all the way down to 500,000 or something like that. That's a great story. We don't know if that, we still got to wait 10 years to find out if, you know, one surge of dominance makes the player. You know, we don't know if that was a good pick yet or not. It, based on what he was for the last month of the college season or whatever, like, yeah, all right, sure. It, that's your top college guy. Like, all right, I don't necessarily agree, but I'm not going to argue with you. Like, sure. So we don't know yet, but you're right. Like, that's a thing that would not have happened if we didn't have the draft later. But I still think that's kind of outweighed by all the bad parts of it, unfortunately.
Yeah. So last thing I have for you, I don't know how mad this is going to make you, but you're on the Future Sox podcast. What the heck is going on with the Detroit Tigers? Like, my goodness, like we've had some buddies on that are Tiger guys talking about Alavila and just what do you think is going to happen? I'm pretty sure I think I know what you think should happen, but what is the end game here? Like, is this finally new regime time in Detroit? And then how does that affect AJ Hinch? If so,
So I'm not going to pretend to have any sort of inside information on this, but my gut is this is probably the last year. They'll probably wait till the end of the season and try and do it as quietly as they can. And I would imagine that AJ Hinch will get to have an opinion on who the replacement should be. That's my gut feeling on it. I think Hinch is probably more likely to be in the long-term plans than the current GM, but that's just a hunch. I don't know that to be the case, but a lot of building a club into a contender takes a little bit of luck, and sometimes you get bad luck, and that's not necessarily your fault, but they've been bad for 7 years. That's too long. That's too long.
Thanks to James for that interview, filling in for me there, talking to Brian Zukowski of Perfect Game. And James, that was insightful. I was really excited to hear what Brian thought of the draft class, especially some of the pitchers like Jonathan Cannon as a bottom end mid rotation starter. I'll take that. He seems like he can project to the big leagues pretty quickly, according to Brian. And some of the insight too, I think specifically that you wanted to note and follow up on, was the value that Noah Schultz brings to the organization. I guess the White Sox, well, obviously they love him, but the White Sox have something that could be special sitting there as a prep pitcher, the left-handed starter Noah Schultz.
Yeah, so I mean, he was super highly regarded, obviously, as one of the, there were three prep lefties early in the class that were very highly regarded. I guess Brandon Barrero went to Toronto, and the Cubs took Jackson Ferris in the second round, but they gave him $3 million, obviously. And then there was Noah Schultz. And look, we've talked about Noah Schultz and the stuff with Boris and Vanderbilt and all the money and how we thought he was going to get, a big time overslot deal, and he signed for slot. I think, and Mike Shirley kind of indicated this, and Brian said it too, the White Sox were in a spot where they wanted to take pitching if they could. And there were some college guys on the board who they liked. And there were college guys that they projected as pretty safe mid-rotation starters in the future. And instead of that, they said, give me the highest upside guy. They legit think that Noah Schultz could be an ace. They think he has top of the rotation potential. It doesn't mean he's going to be, but at 26, I'm totally fine with them taking that type of shot on a guy. And something you brought up, on an earlier episode, Mike Shirley has a type, man. This makes a lot of sense after the fact, right? I don't, nobody predicted Noah Schultz to the White Sox, but after the pick was made, I think we were both like, oh, okay, yeah, that guy fits Mike Shirley. So yeah, I think a lot of this makes perfect sense now. And then what they did after was obviously very intriguing, and it all kind of falls into place by Noah Schultz signing for, $2.8 million in the first round. That part was pretty helpful.
Yeah, something insightful too that Brian provided was the fact that the White Sox had a pretty basic strategy this year across the 20 rounds, where we saw in previous years the White Sox go overslot in certain rounds, which kind of redistributed their bonus pool across the first 10 in various ways. But this year is pretty straight up, and Brian credited the White Sox for that strategy because they got everybody essentially that they were looking for, who they thought were valuable signings, and also players who we're going to sign. And I'm excited about Jordan Sprinkle too. I want to watch him play. James, as we move on, and we're getting closer to wrapping up this episode, got some news from Baseball America. Colson Montgomery ranked number 38 on their top 100 list. That's top 100 in all of baseball. The White Sox have something special and now officially a top 40 prospect, according to Baseball America.
And I think the biggest thing, I think a lot of people project Colson Montgomery for above average power at some point, right? He's got 8 homers across both levels of A-ball. And I just think the biggest thing is just the on-base ability wasn't expected because he wasn't a baseball circuit kid, right? He was a multi-sport athlete. This is the kind of stuff that, like, you don't know. And he's just been, he's been really, really good. I think the people who told us that they thought he could stay at shortstop seem to be, it seems to be trending that way at this point, right? But even if not, like, he has enough bat for third. This is pretty much best case scenario right now for the White Sox 2021 first rounder in Colson Montgomery. He just keeps rising up these lists. So this is, it's been pretty promising for him. I can't say that I expected it.
A 50 game on base streak, an advanced approach at the plate. We heard it from various guests already on the Future Sox podcast, which you can go and listen to. Subscribe anywhere if you'd like what you're hearing now. And if you'd like to continue following the White Sox as we are, come and join us. Follow us on Twitter as well, at Future Sox. And if you're interested, send us an email. We can talk to you directly on this here podcast, futuresox@gmail.com, if you're interested in sending us any questions or comments about what we have to offer for you, also at soxmachine.com. Now, James, as we wrap things up, Kylie McDaniel put out some rankings of farm systems across Major League Baseball. What about those intrigued you?
Yeah, so I just thought it was interesting, like, he did it post-draft. I think more are coming. I think the top 30 update from Baseball America is coming. We will talk to Bill Mitchell again soon. So Kylie had the White Sox 29th still. And look, I think it's fair to have them in the bottom five. I mean, what they've just added to their system, like, everybody just added to their system. I think the system's better. I think it's improving. You know, I think we talked about Colson Montgomery and Brian Ramos is improved, and Oscar Colas is, you know, close to the majors. So, you know, somewhere in that 20 to 30 range, I'm not going to, like, say that Kylie McDaniel's wrong for having the White Sox 29th, but, you know, there's some systems that he had ranked ahead of them, like, that I would prefer the White Sox system over. So I think that's it. I think we're just going to see, you know, as these rankings come out, like, how different it looks. The one takeaway that I had, like, I still think, you know, and our list of Future Sox will be coming out pretty soon. We keep talking about that. Like, I think Lenin Sosa is, like, being underranked a little bit. Like, I think what he did at Double A is real. He obviously came out for a tiny sample in the big leagues, and the manager won't play him anyway. But I just, like, think that that was real growth from a guy that's a major leaguer soon. And I feel like they're like, not getting credit for that development yet. So that's the only thing where I just kind of feel like, you know, everybody knows Montgomery, Colas is mentioned, and, you know, I think, like, Jorge Vero was mentioned and Brian Ramos, but I don't really see Lenin Sosa mentioned that often. And he's only 22, and he put up the monster season that he did in Double A, and now he's in Charlotte. I think he's a little bit better than, you know, than how he's being ranked currently.
That's James Fox of Future Sox. He's the senior writer for our platform, as well as my co-host here on the Future Sox podcast. James talked to Brian Sikowski of Perfect Game, just essentially a scout, a roaming scout. He gets familiar with all of the products across all the country for Perfect Game, which is awesome. And he provided a ton of information on the White Sox draft class currently. He also provided very optimistic information regarding Colson Montgomery, as we talked about it as well. It seems like the White Sox have something special there. Also, I keep referring back in my mind the Keith Law listing of top 100 prospects. Really, it's the top 60 prospects in the country. And Colson Montgomery was on that list. And just missing that list was Brian Ramos. So to us, as we're thinking out loud about our top 30 here at Future Sox, James, this is where I'm at. Montgomery has to be one, and this is a little sneak peek. This is for you, the dedicated listener, for sticking around this podcast. We're going to give you a little preview of what we're working on in the top 30. But here's my thought process, right? Montgomery at the top, that's a no-brainer. If Brian Ramos, according to Keith Law, is just outside the top 60 in the entire Major League Baseball prospect pool, then he's got to be a top three prospect. But he's not number two, in my opinion, because I think Oscar Colas is that dude. So Montgomery, Colas, Ramos, then it gets interesting because you and I are very high on Jorge Vera. However, Lenin Sosa deserves to be in the mix as well. And Christian Mena deserves to be in the conversation as well. Same with Noah Schultz, as a guy who Brian Sikowski said has Randy Johnson absolute top end ceiling attached to his profile. So, and look, that's a lot to say. And like, again, with, was it Peyton Paulette who was compared to, who is that, the Dodgers pitcher?
Yeah, Peyton Paulette has gotten Walker Buehler comps. And I think, so they're like similar in stature, and they both like missed time, I think is generally what the comp is. So
you got Peyton Paulette being comp to Walker Buehler. You got Noah Schultz at his absolute peak being comp to Randy Johnson. You got Colson Montgomery, a top 40 prospect, according to Baseball America. And Brian Ramos, apparently, according to Keith Law, who's really good on hitting prospects, has Ramos just outside the top 60 in all of baseball. So the White Sox farm system is getting there. So we're excited to talk about it, James, coming up in future episodes. You mentioned Bill Mitchell is the guy who's working for Baseball America and keeping a close eye on the White Sox. He is assigned to the White Sox top 30 list for Baseball America. So we're going to get insight from him coming up in future episodes. But James, that's what we're working on, is the top 30 for the White Sox. And the top 10 is going to be interesting to talk about together.
You know, there might be some qualms about who goes where, but I think we know who those names are. And yeah, like the interesting thing about Keith Law is if he put 60 names down and then 10 just missed names, and Brian Ramos is one of the just missed names, like, you know, I don't really like math, but Brian Ramos is a top 70 prospect in baseball, according to Keith Law.
That's what I'm talking about. White Sox are on their way back, kind of, I guess. I don't know if you want to call it that, but let's be optimistic for a week until the White Sox figure out another way to let us down and be disappointed in them. James, this was fun. Thanks for doing the interview with Brian. It was an awesome experience to be able to sit back, relax, and listen to you guys talk it up about Major League Baseball, amateur draft, as well as the prospects that the White Sox were able to obtain and improve their farm system. We're going to, like I said, work on the top 30 for futuresox.com and soxmachine.com. So keep an eye on that. We have our writers putting together their individual top 30s as well. Stay tuned for more information about the Chicago White Sox farm system here at futuresox.com. We're going to talk to you all next week. Until then, thanks so much for listening.